Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the meaning of awakening as awakening relates to the first noble truth. Included in this talk is a 20-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation and Sangha discussion and Q&A, and concludes with meta-intentional meditation. This talk was recorded at our Saturday morning Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey on July the 2nd, 2016.
This morning's class is on awakening to the first noble truth. So, let me read it. The meditation method I teach is called Shamatha Vipassana meditation, and that was the meditation method that the Buddha used as his tool towards awakening. But he also taught this meditation within a broader framework called the Eightfold Path. And so when the Buddha awakened, his very first teaching was a teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And everything he taught for the next 45 years was in the context of developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And so meditation is one tool to use out of this Eightfold Path to develop this understanding. So awakening to the first noble truth is to fully comprehend the nature of dukkha. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, Setting the Wheel of Truth in Motion, the Buddha describes awakening very simply and directly. The noble truth of, I should preface that by saying dukkha, it means every type of unsatisfactory or disappointing experience, from a minor disappointment to extreme mental and physical suffering. It covers that whole thing. And included in that is a mind that is confused and agitated because of that confusion. And so the Buddha taught truths. That's the opposite of being confused. You know what's going on. So the awakening to the first noble truth means that the noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended. We understand the nature of our own suffering and our own confusion. And then he went on to describe awakening to the other noble truth. The noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned. So the second noble truth is that craving and clinging originates and perpetuates ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering. So awakening to that means that you have understood the process and you've abandoned craving and clinging. Make sense? Simple and direct. Awakening to the third noble truth means the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha has been experienced. We fully developed the path. And then awakening to the fourth noble truth is that you've developed the Eightfold Path to its conclusion, to a complete development of the Eightfold Path. You've fully integrated into your life. Because most of what I said is unfamiliar, it seems complicated to most minds. In fact, to many minds, it seems almost unachievable. How can I do this? But that, again, that's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, and he didn't just say, I'll go meditate and figure it out. He taught a framework for recognizing where craving and clinging originates and exactly how to abandon it. So, through wholehearted practice of integrating the Eightfold Path into one's life, the first noble truth of stress is comprehended or fully understood. The Buddha is not referring to an intellectual understanding of the concept of stress in the phenomenal world. What the Buddha is referring to is a deep and profound, dispassionate awareness of the truth of stress, which is something most of us just want to ignore, or at least avoid, not have to deal with. It's almost hardwired into a human being, especially in the West, that anything that brings us displeasure is to be avoided at all costs. And what the Buddha recognized is that you can't avoid it. No matter what you want to do, it's simply part of life. And inherent in every moment is an underlying possibility for disappointment. And that's because of all things are impermanent. So even the things that we acquire that bring us pleasure, at some point are going to cease to exist. Usually it's pretty quick, and usually it's against our own wishes. You know, when we finished that last piece of chocolate cake, no matter how good it was and how big it was, we're still disappointed. It wasn't enough. Yeah. Ah, good. I was wondering where she was.
It was wrong. It was wrong. He stopped me immediately.
Ah, nice. Good morning. It's good to see you, Jen. So the Buddha is describing, I'm talking about awakening to the first noble truth. So the Buddha is describing his own awakening experience. And this is really remarkable what he says. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard or seen before. This is the first noble truth of stress. This noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. This noble truth of stress is comprehended. So despite all the magical and mystical connotations we put on the Buddha and his awakening, it all relates to this first noble truth and understanding the general unsatisfactory nature of life. And why is that important? So that we can live lives of lasting peace and happiness no matter what's occurring. We understand the process that we're in. We use meditation to deepen our concentration so that we're not distracted by stress and we can see it clearly and abandon our part in it, our own craving and clinging. And that describes a fully awakened or a fully mature human being. Yes?
Okay.
You always have such great questions.
No, I know, but... Okay, so you recognize your craving and clinging and then you try to abandon it, renounce it, but you're... That, I'm not asking this very well. So... It seems like it's contradictory that you can, there's stress and you can't avoid it, but you can live a life of lasting peace and happiness at the same time. So it's just you not getting caught up in that and feeding the what's going on at the moment.
You use the most important word you just said was you. So go, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I hope I didn't wreck your chain of thought, but to make that point. It's when we personalize the ongoing process of life in the phenomenal world. When the Buddha described dukkha, he started with birth. Birth is painful. Sickness is painful. Aging is painful. Death is painful. Then he went on to say being separated from that which we love is painful. It could be a person. It could be a situation. It could be food. Could be in shelter. Being separated from what is loved is painful. Associating with that which is unloved is painful. Being with people you'd rather not be, or being in a situation you'd rather. Those, what he's describing are common occurrences that none of us can avoid. So then what he's saying is it's our reaction to things that is the problem. And we react to things because we take it personally, meaning we are identifying with the situation rather than recognizing it's simply part of being in the world. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, you brought something up last week or the week before about desire. And I was thinking about that just yesterday. It's not desire, meaning having a mindfulness that's inclined towards the next meal or having proper shelter or that our children are well taken care of and nothing terrible happens to them. It's when we create an identity over these things, when we take them personally, that we get into trouble and we start creating a distracted and confused mind because we don't understand the process. So when we can depersonalize this, when we're not seeing life from the point of view of a self-referential ego personality, and rather than the ego simply being a function of the mind, a point of reference in this ongoing becoming, then we live lives of lasting peace and happiness.
So by that you mean, by not personalizing it, you mean to recognize that it's happening and that you don't have to do anything about it, or you can be in it.
It depends on the situation. So, a good example. I got hit by the storm yesterday, and it blew out two TVs, a modem, a bunch of electronics. It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this natural process. Another way of saying that is if I wasn't living in this world,
uh-huh,
it still would have occurred. Now, it wouldn't have happened in my TVs, but it still would have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to take that personally. some people would see that as, well, I'm just living under a dark cloud and these kind of things happen to me, or it's bad karma. The same is true when this physical body does not perform as well at 60 as it did at 20. But I can't take that personally. It's simply part of having a human life.
And you can't live your life trying to change it, or, you know, to obsessively stay young, because then you're trying to...
And people do all kinds of things.
Something that is not a part of reality.
It's not a part of reality. So that doesn't mean that I don't do what I can to take good care of this body, because it affects my moment-by-moment becoming, and it certainly affects the quality of my mind. But I don't have an identity about, oh, I need to live forever, or I need to be able to do the things at 60 that I did at 20. I can't. It's just a matter of seeing things and not taking any of that personally. And not wanting anything to be different than it is. But that doesn't mean that we don't continue to make choices and decisions that are appropriate for our well-being. So when the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, he taught it as the middle way, meaning it's the middle way between extreme views and actions. And one extreme view would be complete asceticism. I don't need anything, including food, or a very severe way of looking at the world that denies our own humanness. Or the other extreme view of giving in to every sensory indulgence that we possibly can have. The Eightfold Path is a middle path between those extremes. It allows us to be human beings and live lives as human beings, because that's what we are, without the need for it to be any different than it is. And ultimately what that leads to is a calm and peaceful mind, which is the most important thing. Because no matter how we view the world, the truth of the matter is all of life takes place through our thinking process and how we experience it. And so if we can have the correct thinking, right understanding, which is what this talk is today, then we are completely accepting of life as life occurs without it to be any different than it is in this moment. That doesn't mean that we won't do something to continue or even to change our lives. So when I gave a talk, I keep thinking about this, I think the first retreat, just talking about abandoning personal desire. Someone put up their hand and I was expecting it. He says, well, what happens when a train's coming at you? Meaning, shouldn't you have the desire to... And that was my answer. When a train is coming at you, you move two steps to the left. You don't need to think about it. You're not... It would be foolish to say, well, there's no me here. Bam! Because the next moment is not going to be calm and peaceful. But it also doesn't mean that you have to move two steps to the left and you resent the fact that you had to move. That's taking it personal. What is that train doing in my life? What is sickness, aging, and death doing in my life? It's part of life. Why do I have to go to work tomorrow? Because I want to eat. Because I want to pay the rent, you know. I want to. Those are all reasonable things to consider, but don't take it personally. And we can take that to extreme levels that lead to psychoses, lead to depression and anxiety, leads to compulsive behavior. You know, what is compulsive behavior? It's the need to constantly take care of this ego personality in usually very destructive ways. I mean, I know that firsthand. So when we can diminish the need to satisfy an insatiable self-referential ego personality, when we can end that process, then life is just an ongoing process of becoming. And the next question is, becoming what? Becoming an ongoing, calm, and peaceful, and happy human being, which is exactly what the Buddha was trying to understand, that he developed a way to do that. Does that make sense? Did you have
it? Would it be fair to say that, you know, or just... thinking about this, I mean, we don't have a choice with regards to dukkha. I mean, it's going to exist in this reality, but we have a choice, or choice to awaken, or the resolve to awaken. You know, we have that choice.
Yep.
The choice to interact with dukkha or let it occur moment by moment as it occurs. You know, it's unfortunate a train is coming at you, but you have the choice to step aside. It's unfortunate that I have to deal with something at work, but I have to deal with it, and I don't have to attach to it. It's just occurring.
That's right.
And, you know, I can choose to attach to it and get all stressed and say, well, this didn't go the way I wanted it to, and wow, it could have gone this way. And then where am I? I'm running in a hamster wheel.
Yep.
Instead of samadhi, calm abiding, you know,
yeah,
as it occurs. Dukkha.
That's it.
That guy cut me off on the road. It's unfortunate, but I'm still making the choice to come to my sangha today.
Yeah.
Boy, it would have been nice to sleep another hour, but that's dukkha. Now I'm sitting with others.
Yeah,
it's like perspective. It's, I feel like it's really just shifting how you look at the situation, but somehow it also just, and it's release, it just releases you from.
Yeah, because you're not taking it personally. So right,
maybe.
Right perspective is right view. You know, that's the first factor of the Eightfold Path, right view. And so ultimately, right view is the view that understands the Four Noble Truths, that there is stress. Usually the First Noble Truth is described in its most simplest way that way. There is stress. There is dukkha. There's no choice. If we have a human life, there's going to be stress. Meaning there's going to be stress using that there's a disappointing, an underlying unsatisfactory nature to all things because everything is impermanent.
Even dukkha is impermanent.
Even an immediate unpleasant experience is impermanent. And so it only rises to the level of stress when we feel that it is permanent. Or we need it to change immediately. I'm having an unpleasant experience. It has to be over now.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than take a breath and it will be over because everything comes to cessation. Everything. So
on life's terms.
It really is that from the understanding, from the right view or the right perspective, that there is going to be disappointment. So we have it locked in. And again, especially in the West, but it's spread globally now. The reason why I say that is there was a lot of Southeast Asian countries that really didn't have a difficulty with personalizing things to the extent that we do in the West. And this is not a recent occurrence. It's a multi-generational occurrence going back hundreds of years. I want to forget. Dennis, you had a question.
No, I was just going to say it's about taming your ego, maybe.
Yes, well, taming, it's about recognizing a self-referential ego personality and allowing that to run your life and form your perspective. Everything is happening to this thing that I insist is a permanent me. When the truth of the matter is that the ego should only be a reference point as a function of your mind rather than something that we use to take everything personally. It's just, there's an ongoing process in every human being's life. And when we don't personalize it, then whatever is occurring is simply a reference to what is occurring. That's true mindfulness. That's the refined mindfulness that's developed, rooted in deep concentration, and then developed through the framework of the Eightfold Path. We're able to see things clearly, which is what the Buddha's talking about. So also notice the Buddha didn't wake up, gain full human maturity, and immediately start describing all the answers to the riddles of the cosmos, where we come from, where we're going, you know, all the other things. Is there such a thing as infinity, or is there not? He didn't care about any of that, although he did allude to the fact that he understood that. He also said, don't worry about it. It doesn't help the issue at hand, which is human peace and happiness. When he set out on his search, at the age of 29, he did so because he recognized the ongoing human suffering that's rooted in competitiveness and aggressiveness. He didn't understand all of that because that's why he set out on his search. And so for 6 years, he did his best not to understand the great answers or the great questions, but to understand human suffering, and that's what he achieved. But he did it for the most compassionate reasons. He understood that that's what everybody's chasing. Everybody wants happiness. Everything we do in the hope that it brings us ongoing happiness. But we're confused and deluded about how to do it. That's dukkha. We have a wrong view. And that wrong view is rooted in what the Buddha called anatta. Another misunderstood application of the Buddhist teaching that people, most of the later developed schools say, well, anatta means non-self or there's no such thing as a self. The Buddha never said that. He says, what you think of yourself is a wrong view. It's not a self. Let go of the views. And when you look at it that way, what the Eightfold Path is really teaching is to recognize and abandon all of your clinging views. And what that means is clinging views that are protecting a self-referential ego self. And so what happens when we let go of all these views? Then the ego is simply a function of the mind. There's nothing personal going on. So it's even hard for some people to imagine that state. What would it be like if I had no self-referential views? So the best example is the Buddha. The Buddha awakened. He let go of every self-referential view, lived his entire last 45 years of his life simply from the reference point of an ego function in his mind, and lived the most successful human life anybody's ever lived, I believe. Nobody's done more, I think. So he didn't become useless because he let go of all self-referential views. He became highly effective. And most people, as they start developing this path, even in a very initial cursory way, say that they're more effective in their life. They're better at what they're doing because they're more mindful of what they're doing. And we're less distracted by satisfying an ego personality in each moment. And the reason why that's so satisfying is you can never satisfy an ego personality. There's never enough for it. You have 9 pieces of chocolate cake, you got to have 10. You have the best round of golf you ever had, you got to have a better one the next time. You have the most pleasant meal you ever had, but next one better be better or you're unhappy. I always think about the green flash. You notice this beautiful sunset and the next one's not so beautiful and you're disappointed. Because I'm attached to last night's sunset, because I'm attached to last night's dinner, because I'm attached to that last conversation I had. Rather than recognizing that me and all of life is in an ongoing process, and if I depersonalize it to the extent that I don't have to approve or disapprove of everything that occurs, I can simply be present. Then I can simply be present. Then I can enjoy every moment in a mindful way because it's part of my life. And then my life doesn't have to be any different than it is. And again, the next thought is, well, don't we need that to motivate us? No, we don't. As human beings, we have a natural motivation to do the things we need to do to preserve human life. We don't have to be distracted by it. We don't have to be consumed by it. We'll do the right thing as long as we have right mindfulness, the 7th factor of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path as a framework for living guides every thought, word, and deed we can do if we allow it, if we develop it that way. And that doesn't mean we need to constantly be thinking of it. When it's integrated into our lives, then our right mindfulness is simply an expression of who we are. That's what this is referring to again, getting back to the awakening. Awakening, as the Buddha describes it, is simply full maturity in understanding the process of being a human being. It's rooted in meditation and it's framed by this Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path gives us the view on how to see things clearly, rooted in a well-concentrated mind. Why do we need meditation? And the Buddha taught a very specific type of meditation too. He studied the other more popular meditation methods before he settled on Shamatha Vipassana, because those meditation practices were designed to develop an experience on our cushion, usually some type of mystical experience that was subtly suggested to you to have. The Buddha used meditation simply to develop concentration so that that concentration would support the refined mindfulness necessary to see things clearly. period. There's really no other reason to meditate. We'd like to have other, we'd like to be able to use meditation as an escape or as a way to develop wonderful experiences or a way to develop a trance-like state. And I could teach you meditation methods that would do that very quickly, but I won't, because I've tried them all and I found them more distracting than anything else. Because what I realized for myself is I needed to find a way to be well concentrated rather than use my meditation to further distract me. And that's probably the big difference between what the Buddha taught as meditation and what other meditation methods. And I'm not saying every meditation method does that. But my first meditation method was transcendental meditation, which is a mantra-based, word-based meditation. And it was very effective initially. And I practiced it for about 2 years. But for about the last year, I had kept coming up with, there's got to be more to this. This doesn't, you know, I've developed a measure of calm in my mind, but I don't quite understand why. And TM back then, this is back in the early to mid-80s, as well as today, once you start getting those questions, you're asked to spend quite a bit of money to learn the other levels. And that didn't seem quite right. It was very secretive. And that caused me to start looking at different meditation methods, and eventually, long process, I came to understand this is what the Buddha used to meditate and why he taught meditation. I initially thought that meditation alone was going to give me the understanding that the Eightfold Path gave me. And even during all my years in other Buddha schools, I might have heard the Four Noble Truths mentioned or the Eightfold Path kind of mentioned, but it was never taught in a way that this is the path. In fact, it was hardly ever taught at all in most of the other Buddhist schools, because it doesn't relate to their intention, it doesn't relate to what their goal is. The Buddha is simply trying to teach how to understand stress and how to bring it to cessation. Why? So that we can live lives of lasting peace and happiness in this life. Again, the Buddha wasn't concerned about future lives because he understood that if we take care of this life, in fact, a better way of saying it is if we can understand this moment, then we understand everything. If we understand ourself in relation to the world in this moment. So the Buddha taught those three marks of existence: anicca, impermanence; anatta, not self-characteristic; and resulting dukkha. That those three marks of existence are always occurring in our lives. Now we can either be distracted by impermanence of all things, or we can be detached from all of that, not clinging to things, and then life is just an ongoing continuum of becoming. Becoming what? Becoming yourself. There's a kind of a modern religion about the present moment. You got to be in the present moment. It's a good idea, but there's no such thing as the present moment. We can get fixated on this is what's occurring right now. Life is simply an ongoing process of becoming. And we don't have to get fixated on any one thing or even one moment. Simply recognize that we are the process. Does that last sentence make sense to you? We are the process. Mm-hmm. Our life is occurring to us. It's not occurring out there. That doesn't mean that there's an infinite universal unfolding of experience. But life occurs within our minds. So we don't have to be distracted by what is occurring. We can simply be present. The reason why I say that is a self-referential ego personality needs constant distraction and constant sensory fulfillment. It needs to always be engaged with what's going on outside of itself because it's created an identity in everything that it sees. Does that last sentence make sense?
Yeah, but I always forget that. I just need to hear it all the time. I need to get like a recording of your voice so that I'm okay.
All right. Okay. Well, here's
all the times that this, I like get out of, feeling just getting clinging.
And creating an identity over that.
Come back, and I'm like, okay, yeah. Say it again.
And creating an identity over those mundane things that we attach to.
Right.
For instance,
putting yourself in
something as mundane as a purple zafu. The zafu is that little pillow there. as a self-referential ego personality, the first thing that comes to mind is I really prefer green, not purple. It doesn't matter. But there's an identity I've created over that. I've created an attachment to that Zafu being different than it is. And it doesn't, you could take that, well, it's purple, it's just a beautiful color. I don't have to see it that way either. It's just there. It's something that's part of my existence that I do not have to approve of. Do you see the difference? Now, if I'm going to go out and buy a Zafu and I prefer green, I'll probably buy green. But it won't be because I need to have green in my life to be happy. Again, I'm using kind of a silly example to make the point. But we do that with much more important things, and we do that with things that that cannot be any different than they are, including that Zafu, that it's just a Zafu. We do it with other people and with situations constantly, and that's where the real stress arises, wanting the people and events of our lives to be different than they are, including ourselves. That's where stress arises. So if you can recognize that life is an ongoing process of becoming, and the purpose of human life is to be truly happy without attachment, then we let go of all things. Lao Tzu, the great Chinese philosopher, says, once we recognize the impermanence of all things, we'll let go of everything. Most importantly, once we recognize the impermanence of this self-referential ego personality, we'll let go of the need for it to be permanent. And then what happens? Then the ego is simply a function of the mind, a reference point, that is present for life as life unfolds. Is that clear? Relatively so, because that's really what the path is about, and that's what we're talking about this morning, developing that understanding. So me saying it or the Buddha saying it is not enough to fully understand it. That's the point. When the Buddha said, Ehipasiko, come and see for yourself, that's what he's saying. Develop, use this framework of the Eightfold Path, rooted in meditation, to have this experience yourself. The third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha, has been experienced. The Buddha made that one of the noble truths to point out the importance. And then how do we have that experience? We develop the Eightfold Path. So there's a lot more into this in this article that I'm not going to read because I've talked too much today, but it's on the website and it's linked in the email. But any questions about this? There's been some great questions already. No? All right, so we'll meditate. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. It's so long.
Greg.
So we're going to meditate, and I'll just talk us into it. It doesn't really need any long instruction. The word shamatha vipassana. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. And it's a very specific type of insight to exactly what we've been talking about, into these three marks of existence, impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and dukkha, and insight ultimately into understanding these four noble truths. So it's rooted in this concentration practice. We use mindfulness of the breath to deepen our concentration. So this meditation method is not to develop a trance-like state. It's not to have any other real experience, although most people will find it relaxing. If you remember that it's primarily for deepening concentration, every time you find that you're caught up in your thoughts again and come back to the sensation of breathing, you're deepening your concentration. So every meditation session is successful. The reason why I say that is many people, especially when they're starting out, get frustrated because they can't stay focused on their breath for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody.
That's me.
So don't get, if all that you need to do is to acknowledge that you're caught up in your thinking, you're back in that story, come back to the sensation of breathing. Both of those components are meditation, not just being mindful of the breath. And then concentration will deepen, and it's supported by the other seven factors. So as you deepen your understanding of the other seven factors, your meditation practice will deepen too, your concentration will deepen. So it's not just one thing. So gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. All right, Greg, I notice how you're sitting. If you're uncomfortable with your legs up like that, especially at first, take a couple of pillows and put them underneath there to hold up your knees. You'll be much more comfortable. And you can do that at home with some rolled up pillows, or if you have some yoga blocks or something like that. Is that better?
Much.
Okay.
Thank you.
And also, this is not a static pose, meaning if you feel like you need to move, if it's just uncomfortable, move. You know, a still body contributes to a still mind. but we shouldn't be so rigid in this that we're afraid to move. So gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight, but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, but holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly, allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle onto your seats, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like, to be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. side thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you can gently open your eyes. So I'd like to hear how your meditation practice is progressing, and if there's any questions, start with Jen. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm probably a couple weeks of, I haven't been here 2 weeks, so maybe that's part of it. I was on a retreat last weekend. Probably just a lot of resistance and clinging happening, so today's been good. It's been helpful. It's just seeing where I'm stuck. You know, like not, it was one of the, but the, while it was all happening, it was like, this isn't really anything significant. There's nothing significant here that's really. That makes sense in terms of my reaction to all of it. Like my reaction seemed more intense than like what was happening, because what was happening it just seemed mundane and like every day.
Yeah.
And so that was like my, that was my hint or clue that I was, you know, stuck.
Yeah.
And so then I just keep. I'm just like, okay, so I'm just stuck in a clinging mind state and just trying to kind of go with that somehow is like helping. And then coming here has been just realizing, you know, the more that I try to work it out, the more I'm in it.
That right effort is a very gentle effort.
Yeah,
without
right.
judgment. Yeah.
And really, like, finding that middle way has been much less effort than what I would think.
Yeah.
I think effort is, like, wrong effort. I'm very good at wrong effort.
Yeah.
Trying, you know, a little too hard and having that be caused a little bit of dukkha. So it's, this has been helpful today to kind of just be really diligent about taking myself out of everything. But not too diligent.
Sometimes I think that it'd be better to use the word right focus rather than right effort.
Okay.
But focus can also have, well, all I have to do is look at it, and there's more to it.
Yeah.
More to it than that. But when you're
just, it's like taking, it's like a heaviness that I'm like taking everything way too seriously, and that's another big clue.
But that's also a important recognition that. Just to be able to see the process,
right.
Because that recognition implies that you have a choice, and that the implication can then lead to an actual choice.
Right.
I don't have to think this way.
Right.
I don't have to react to or overreact to something that is insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
But that you see it is important. A self-referential ego self will just justify that. It'll continue confusion by saying this, the way that I'm thinking and the way that I'm feeling is justified because of whatever that might be.
Yeah.
You know, and really, and ultimately that comes down to, it's justified because this is the way that I'm thinking, which is really discursive when you think about it. I feel upset because I am upset. Well, what's the cause of it? Because
right,
you don't see
right.
the process going on. And that leads to further confusion.
And I think, too, like, just... And this is ego, I guess, maybe. No, my conditioned mind has been conditioned to rationalizing, thinking through, and that is a process that is really helpful in certain applications, but when it comes to like personal emotional anxiety, it's not, it's like you have to stop doing that. You have to just stop that.
Yeah.
And this practice, it's really interesting the way the practice is kind of like, it's like seeping in. And it's loosening like these little pieces.
Yeah.
But it is really trying to keep, the conditioning is really, you know, it's got its momentum.
Yep.
And really like, kind of staying outside of it and just kind of letting it run its course, or just letting it like kind of loosen the fabric. It's
That's the sole reason why the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path, to interrupt that process of dependent origination that keeps us rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. It interrupts our conditioned thinking. When he, after his awakening, he thought for two more weeks about, could he teach what he understood? And how could he do that? And what he was considering was, how am I going to break through the common human problem of conditioned thinking? How do I interrupt that ongoing process? And that's, the Eightfold Path does that. It allows for recognition and renunciation of craving and clinging in all of its forms. And all of its forms really isn't a lot. It's not like there's an infinite number of attachments that we have to face and deal with. There are an infinite number of attachments. Everything that is part of our lives we're attached to. But all we have to do is recognize attachment in general and let it go. And it comes up like that, you know. It's a great realization to react to something, but also to realize that it's insignificant. Because up until that point, you would react to something and consider it. It must be significant simply because I'm reacting.
Yeah.
More discursive thinking.
Yeah.
It's like that, I can't remember who the philosopher is that coined the phrase, I think, therefore I am.
Descartes?
I think so.
Descartes?
Yeah, I think that's right. Which is pretty famous, isn't it? People really like it.
I might have just learned it in the same unit as Descartes.
I think you're right. And a better way of saying that is, the way I think is the way I am. Because that's what determines our experience. And if all that I think I am is this self-referential ego self that can never be satisfied, I'm always going to be unsatisfied. That's the First Noble Truth. But if I simply recognize this ongoing process of a human life, again, there's nothing more magical or mystical about it, except isn't that incredible? I mean, to me now, I used to like to believe in miracles because then they could happen, but I don't believe in miracles anymore. But the most miraculous thing I've ever come across is this understanding. This is my life. And from the time I was the littlest boy, I wanted to be happy. I just didn't know how to do it. I was an angry 10-year-old until later in life. Not because life was awful, it was because it just didn't make any sense. And the things that people were telling me I should be taking as important were all impermanent objects and acquisitions that, again, it didn't seem like this was going to lead to a very fulfilling life. Why should I be chasing these things? Yet it was instilled in me. This is what you should be after. Rather than understanding the workings of my own mind and then being mindful in my life, you know, the most important thing. Judy, good to see you.
Good to see you, Sean, and everybody. My practice is going well. I'm getting, you know, 2 sittings a day in those days, I would say. So that's significant for me.
That is. It's outstanding.
And of course, coming here, and I think in the sitting has helped me, because it's been a kind of a rough time for me lately in my head.
Yeah.
But I'm recognizing. I mean, I always recognize it, but that conditioned thinking is a really hard thing to break out of. But I'm thinking of, you know, I'm calling on the teachings, and I'm thinking just what you were saying, that you know, I always think things are going to be worse than they turn out, you know,
yeah.
I'm anticipating, and so it's all up in here, and that's such a waste of time, and my energy, and my good feeling, and so, so anyway, I'm making progress with that, so I thank you, I see it, I see I'm making progress, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Oh,
thank you. Excuse me. Eva, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I have found that for myself, conditioned thinking, my list of my dependent origination setup is my conditioned thinking developed from my distractions, and my distractions developed from my wanting to escape pain or continue to maintain happiness or to keep things as I want them to be and not accept them as they are. And so then I distract myself so that I don't have to feel the pain or notice what's going on, or, you know, I'm angry, so let me start doing something else. And then I start this habit, which could be drinking, could be drugs, you know, not in my case, but, you know, could be eating, could be anything to distract myself. And those distractions then become my conditioned thinking and my habits that I have such a hard time breaking away from. And then it's like, okay, I'm calm, I'm mellow, I'm good, everything's fine. And then the thing happens and I'm
yeah.
Right back to the same old behavior. And yes, I do, I am aware of it and I see, you know, what's happened. But it's just amazing how deep the clutches are of conditioned thinking. And of course, you know, I've developed it for 57 years of my life. You know, that's what I've been doing. And so it's not going to go away in, you know, a little while. But it's wonderful. I love the path that my life has taken, the direction that coming here and meditation has done, has directed me to or towards, because I feel optimism and I feel joy and I feel happiness, even though my mother has, you know, dementia and she's struggling and my parents are old and gonna die and all the world is in such chaos and children are suffering, I still can find a way to be happy, because, and that's the other thing about the meaning or the word of the word, you know, because when we say happiness, it's like, well, how can you be happy when such things are going on in the world? But there is the possibility of finding a happiness within that we can hope somehow balances out.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we can be happy despite what's going on, because we don't need it to be different. It doesn't mean that we're happy about, you know, a mass shooting or something. That's insane. But we understand it's part of the human condition. And if we really want to change all of those things, we'll take to the Dhamma and awaken, because that's the only way we can have an effect on these kind of things. And there's natural disasters. There's something called worldly causes and conditions. That's part of the Dhamma. So, you know, some people will think that a flood that just took 1,000 people, well, that's bad karma. That's a cruel thing to say. But it is part of just living in the world. These natural disasters occur, period. Nobody's responsible for it. The people that got hurt or killed weren't living under a dark cloud.
Or to say
it's part of living in a human, in the phenomenal world.
Or to say that they're committing some sin and therefore have brought it on themselves.
Yeah. And it's a very convenient thing to develop, too. You know, people are suffering because of what awful people they are.
Right, it hurts less if, you know, they're bad and we're good.
Yeah. Yeah, and doesn't that come from self-identification, whether it's as an individual or as some organized group? I'm better than they are. The political season is always interesting to me, because that's where you really see it. And that... the practical benefits that you talk about, that's important to recognize. It really works. You know, it makes my life better. I remember many, many years ago when I was struggling with trying to even understand what the Buddha was teaching and questioning, was it really worth this right effort? The thought occurred to me, whether this is all nonsense and there was really, you know, this is all a big myth, still a better way to live my life. Of course, now I developed to the point where I realize and studied enough that it's not a myth, you know, that the human being actually did develop this teaching, and it's still here for us today. Thank you. Dennis, good to see you.
Good to see you. My practice is still unfolding. I can feel that in terms of mindfulness, that I'm able to focus more, or I'm able to acknowledge that I'm having a bad thought or a distracting thought and dwell on it less.
Good.
It's funny what you said about trying to escape pain. So much of my thinking seems to be wanting to connect with pain, you know, to be drawn to, I want to move away from the good thing that's happening in front of me to dwell on some bad thing that I think happened long ago or I remember from long ago. And it's just amazing how many of those thoughts creep in. It's like, you know, when they say your life passes before your eyes at the moment, I feel like all the bad things in my life pass before my eyes very often, very fast, in a blink of an eye. And the craziest things will try to creep into what I'm doing. But I feel better able to just kind of park them and get back to what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And not let them, those thoughts, knock me down. I haven't spent a lot of time actively meditating. And I don't know, I've kind of been resisting, I think, setting aside that time every day. So it would be a good thing if I come back here next week and say that I set aside some of that time.
I hope so.
I want to do it.
that resistance is very, very common, and it's part of conditioned thinking. And every time that we sit, when we feel like we don't want to sit, we're diminishing that conditioned response to not wanting to sit. We're helping ourselves. It's part of right effort or right focus. And that the other conditioned response that you talked about, going to a negative experience to kind of minimize any pleasure that might be happening now, that's also part of conditioned thinking. And it's part of a self-referential ego that's familiar with doing that. And so there's no way to stop that unless there's a way to interrupt that process, because it's so automatic. And that's what the Eightfold Path is. You're beginning to recognize it, much like Jen was talking about. Recognition is the beginning of renouncing that ongoing process. And do you see how meditation now fits into that? Because the act of recognizing that you're caught up in your thoughts and coming back to the sensation of breathing interrupts that process internally in our minds. And off our cushions, the concentration that's developed allows for you to recognize when you're caught up in it, when you're off your cushion. Do you see that? I mean, that's how it fits in. That's why it's such an important part of practice, and the intended focus is important too. Why are we doing this?
So I could ask you, you know, I get up and I get up in time so I can spend an hour reading the paper. And it seems like reading the paper now is just counterproductive because you're absorbing all this terrible stuff that's not necessarily part of your experience or what you're about today and right now, but it's all distraction from that.
It is.
So I don't know if that's a bad habit. I always used to think it was a good habit. What do you think about that?
I think it's an unskillful habit. So there was a time in my life I was just like that. I used to read 3 newspapers every morning before I did anything. Back then I wasn't meditating. And I was just living in this dark place. The world was awful. Everything was awful. The world's going to... You know, it was just a terrible way to... And I did this for many years. And it wasn't until I started meditating and gaining an understanding of what that constant exposure was doing to the way I thought, I realized I didn't need to do that. I didn't need to know every little detail that was going on in the world to understand the First Noble Truth, which was more important. That was just a distraction. So it took a little while, but I can't remember the last time I read a newspaper. I mean, it's been many, many years. What I do, and I used to, that going on, I also had the news going on in the background. The TV was always on at my house. This is 20 years ago, at least. And most of it was, what's going on in the world? You know, I need to keep hearing about this. So now I have an aggregator on my iPad, news aggregator. You know, everybody, I think I can't remember the one that I use. I think it's called News 360 or something. And I look at that maybe two or three times a week because I think it's important to understand what's going on in the world, but I don't need to know every detail. And that's enough. You know, I very rarely watch the news. I can't think of the last time I had the TV on and watching the news. So it's about, part of it is about what am I going to let in? You know, my experience is determined by contact through my senses. So I'm in control of that. I mean, almost 100%, not entirely. So it's up to me what I expose myself to or what I associate myself with. And I don't want to know everything that's going on. For one thing, I don't need to know. Why? What can I do about it?
I do find more now that I've started doing this and thinking more about this, I don't need to read this article. I know this happened. You know, I need to know that much. I don't need to go all the way down and read the whole gory details of everything. And, so I think I'm freeing myself from, I think, what used to be a dependency on that. I had to know everything. Because I know enough.
Yeah.
That's probably more than enough already.
The first noble truth describes it. That's enough. Of course, we live in a modern world, and you need to know a little bit more, but we don't need that constant exposure and constant connection and constant distraction. So instead of an hour reading the paper, maybe 10 minutes meditating and 50 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's a realistic way of looking at
this.
And, let me see what Greg has to say, and then we'll talk a little bit more about establishing a practice. Welcome to our Sangha, Greg. How was that
Thank
meditation?
You. I'm so glad I'm here.
We are too.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
It was probably the first time I've ever meditated where, thanks to you and just your saying, focus on the breathing, because the circus in my head is going on and on and on with ridiculous, the fried chicken for tonight for the concert. Like, it's like, it's just...
We're doing fried chicken, too.
Oh, okay, see, well, is that enough?
You better get there.
And then you, oh my God, I didn't even think of that. And then, but you know what? You saying, focus on your breath. Because honestly, I showed Dennis some of it. The 10-minute guided meditation I do every morning, I chose because I have such a hard time with turning the noise off in my head. But I kind of feel like it's cheating, and it's not doing for me what I feel like a meditation should be doing. And this today allowed me to be present and stay in the present and meditate. And I found myself, once I focused on the breathing and shut all the nonsense off, I almost was falling asleep, which is amazing to me because I'm always like, go, 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 you know, like crazy person. So it really, I thought, was so beneficial for me, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and for sharing that. Everybody says the same thing. There's just so much noise. The circus is always going on. The point of meditation, again, is to deepen concentration. So that doesn't mean that you get to the point where there's an absence of thought. That's impossible. Again, I can teach you a technique that will very quickly create the appearance that, or the experience that you're not thinking. But it's just a way of tricking ourselves. We're human beings. Just like our blood is always coursing through our bodies if we're alive, thoughts are always flowing. The purpose of meditation is to simply not be distracted by that story. So you let the story go, focus on your breath, and you're deepening your concentration. And that leads to all the rest of this. So welcome to our Sangha. And you're meditating 10 minutes a day. If that's comfortable for you, what I normally tell people when they're first starting out with meditation, start with shorter periods of time, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Do that twice a day around 12 hours apart, and very soon you'll have a full-fledged meditation practice. Most important thing is to be very gentle with yourself, use the method as it's described, and if you can be part of a sangha, a group of meditators like we have here. There is a recording of this on my website, so you can download it and use that as a guided meditation. There's 5 or 6 years of articles and talks from classes that I've given. So you can deepen your understanding of the Eightfold Path. But most important is to be part of our Sangha and be very gentle with yourself, what you're going to learn.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're a part of it. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everybody. Just having some good insight into life as life occurs. You know, I had some interesting things happening, but you know, it's funny. You were mentioning this transcendental meditation or something like that to put you in a state, and I kind of just, I don't want to say I laugh, but it brings a chuckle to my face because, you know, I'm grateful for this understanding because I don't want to be in a trance in my life. I want to be experiencing it. I don't want to go, I'm not looking for something to escape it. I'm looking for something to experience it, right? So people tend to think that there's something that can just mute the whole thing and we're just going to go through and, you know, walking around like it'll all be okay. But it does take some of this effort. And I've had a lot of people asking me, you know, what's your plan or what are your priorities? And, you know, I just laugh at that. I'm just like, well, my plan is to live a happy life, you know, and not have it be different. And, you know, having a plan is like wanting it to be different, you know. I mean, yeah, I need a plan, okay, I need to do this, and I'd like to achieve this if I can, and if I, you know. But it's funny, people, I think it's coming from my professional life. I have people that are looking at me like, you know, maybe people that are managing me, and like, wow, like, are you working hard enough? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, you don't look very stressed. Like, well, look, I'm doing a lot of work. I'm sorry, you know, you're doing it your way, and, you know, you're, you know, stressed, chest beating, yes, hair's falling out. It's like, oh, it's okay, you know, that's a good choice you made. That's your choice, but it's not how I'm doing it, you know. I mean, I'm grateful for that. You know, I mean, I have other people that aren't professionally in my life, friends, or what's your plan? Like, for something like this, a beautiful day, what's your plan? How much are you going to get out of this day? It's like, you know, I'd be just as happy sitting by the river all day. I mean, yeah, would I like to join a friend for a bike ride or see the fireworks later? Sure. But I'm not going to sit and say, well, I got to be here, and here, and here. And, wow, man, I didn't get anything out of this day. Oh, boy. You know, well, it was a beautiful day anyway. But it's just fun. I have fun with this, and I don't like to take it too lightly, but I'm very grateful for that sort of freedom and release and unbinding that we've all been working on together, and couldn't do it without everybody here. So grateful for the practice and the sangha. thank you
Kevin. So it's interesting what's come up talking about this today, and the idea of the chicken. And where's the party, by the way? Because that chicken sounds really good.
Oh, okay.
Mom was talking about that earlier.
Let's get the sangha to go. Mindful experience of fireworks.
Yeah.
I wanted the green firework. I didn't get it. I got a pink one. Darn.
You remind me. I don't want to get into that story. The idea of we're bringing chicken to the picnic tonight is reasonable, and it's reasonable to plan it and buy it and cook it and have it ready. That's not something we shouldn't be doing. That's not a distraction. But when we're sitting in meditation, thinking about did I buy enough chicken? Is it the right? That's a distraction.
Right.
And that's where a self-referential ego self. What are people going to think of me if the chicken's not right?
Exactly.
You do what you can do. You buy the chicken. You do whatever you have to do. You got to get up tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. You set the alarm to do it. It doesn't mean that we lose our... What's the phrase that I use? It's good to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. We make plans. But when those plans fall through or something intervenes, like impermanence, we're okay with it. We don't have to react to it. And if you do react to it, it's not wrong. It just means you need to recognize what it's doing to you. Creating agitation in your mind. What do you want to have in your life? You want lasting peace and happiness? There's a way to do it, and it's a pretty simple and direct way. It doesn't take a lot of effort, but it takes right effort. It takes learning a few other different skills and a few different concepts, and then we can let go of all that stuff that's been holding us back and live lives of lasting peace and happiness. Thank you for a wonderful class this morning. We're not finished yet, though. A few announcements.
Right,
2 weeks from yesterday is a 12-step workshop right here in this room. July 30th at Hunterdon Integrative Medicine is the next mindfulness-based recovery workshop. I'm teaching now on Thursday nights in Lambertville at Phillips Barber at 7:30. So another class a week. Let's finish with my rendition of metta. So metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and this is an intentional meditation. The metta is a good thing to use if we're having difficulty meditating because of an agitated mind, because we're holding ill will towards other people or towards ourselves. You can use, this is on the website too, you can use metta. It'll help clear that ill will and relax your mind so that you can meditate. So,
M-E-T-A?
M-E-T-T-A. On the website at the top of the navigation bar is guided meditations. Click on that and then you'll see a few different meditations that you can download and listen to, and there's some instruction there. Also on the website is you can sign up for a newsletter, and I send a newsletter out twice a week with the class topics for that week and any changes in classes. So, yeah, M-E-T-T-A. So gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any thoughts that are distracting to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And in metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves. And generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. And may I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that you care deeply for, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. Now bring to mind each other in this room this morning, and all the other members of our Sangha, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation, to include all sentient beings, and generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. This concludes our meditation practice this morning. Thank you all for being here. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.